You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, and welcome to Giving Up the Ghost Cast with me, Shannon Kyle.
And me, Tina Lyons.
Tina and I are two real-life, multiple best-selling ghostwriters who would like to lift the veil on the publishing industry's best-kept secret, the world of ghostwriting.
Well, you probably never heard of us. There's a very good chance you've read our words.
So who are ghostwriters? How does ghostwriting work? And how do most bestsellers get written?
I'm so glad you are, Shannon. Let's listen to Giving Up the Ghost Cast to find out.
Hello and welcome to Giving Up the Ghost Cast. Thanks for joining us and hello to you, Tina.
Hi, Shannon. It's lovely to be back. How's your week been?
Well, it's been very busy. As you know, the Ghostwriters Agency, we actually held an event, our very first social, where ghosts from all over the country came to join us, even flying in from Glasgow.
Some of whom have already appeared on the show. I mean, that was part of the reason behind starting the Ghostwriters Agency, is actually to get ghosts together and speak to other ghosts, because it can be quite an isolating experience. So it was incredible to have 15 ghosts in one pub garden all chatting about ghostwriting. One of the things that they said to me was, it's so nice to meet somebody else and not have to go through the rigmarole of what do you do and don't you mind not getting your name on the cover and all the questions that we always hear as ghosts.
Yeah, there was definitely a collective understanding about what we all do. I think we're going to call it a haunting, aren't we? That was what we decided afterwards. I mean, what's just brilliant about it is that, you know, one of the reasons why we set up the Ghostwriters Agency is because we saw that there was a bit of a gap in the market, as it were, not just for an agency that primarily have best-selling ghosts, but also just for the social side of it. And we've had ghosts, like I say, from all over the country. We've had more ghosts than we can take on. There is this real sort of feeling of community, a supportive network, and that I'm sure is hopefully for years to come will be really helpful.
Absolutely, and very enjoyable afternoon it was too.
It was.
Right, well, now we're going to hear from another ghostwriter, someone I've been very much looking forward to having on the show.
That's right. I'm about to speak on Zoom with Sunday Times best-selling ghostwriter Katie Whites, who's ghosted some incredible real-life stories, including The Secret Midwife and number one bestseller Sins of the Mother by Irene Kelly. So let's hear from Katie now. Katie, as an experienced ghostwriter of more than 20 books, you've mentioned by the time the average author crosses your path, they've already seen the inside of plenty of therapy rooms, and that above all, they need honesty from the publishing professionals. Can you tell us why you think that is?
I think by the time a lot of my authors have come to me, they've been through multiple experiences. Obviously, some of them have been through trauma, and part of the reason they're doing the book is as a catharsis to work through their trauma. They might have been to court. In fact, quite a lot of them have been to court, and that's the reason we can do the story, is because there is incontrovertible proof that what they're saying happened. And they have also obviously had to deal with these things in their lives and maybe had several rounds of counselling or therapy, or in some way try to work through the issues that they've experienced. And then they get to the stage of writing a book, and quite often they will be very excited about this, understandably, because it's an exciting thing to do. And they see this as a sort of the answer to all the issues that might have come up in the past. For example, in court, you only really get to give the side of the story where you give evidence in support of the charge. So you might not actually be able to give your backstory. How you've come to that point, how you've got into that position is not really explained. So having a day in court sometimes isn't really that at all. It's just a very small amount of evidence in a very narrow defined remit, which you're lawyer lays down for you, and after that it's all over. So that can be very unsatisfying, and some people feel that they have to explain what's happened to them. Perhaps they haven't had a chance to speak in the past. Perhaps their voice has been silenced. In fact, that's been the case for a lot of people I've dealt with. A lot of abuse victims have been told they can't speak, they're not allowed to tell people what's been happening, and therefore being able to regain their voice is a very important part of their therapy and healing, in order to claim back their ability to tell people their truth. Again, very important thing to do. And the book is sometimes seen as the way to do this. And that's all great. I think it's wonderful. And I've done many books like that. But what I find quite often is a lack of clarity from commercial publishers towards these authors on how this then proceeds from this point onwards. And particularly with regards to telling one's story, there are restrictions on that. They are often not given that information at the outset. So, for example, they're not told. We have something in this country called libel laws, which means that you can't say anything you like about people. We are quite restricted in what you can say about people. There's also privacy laws which impinge on their ability to tell their story authentically. So, for example, if somebody's been in a situation where they can reasonably expect a degree of privacy in the bedroom, for example, or in a private conversation, you are restricted in your ability to tell that. So these sort of things don't get clearly explained at the outset. And unfortunately, that has led to, in my case, in my experience, quite a few people having pain, anguish, trauma, and deep upsets quite a way down the road in the process. So I think there is a need to lay out a little bit more clearly from the outset what people can expect. And managing expectations is really important so that they don't feel at the end of it that they've been exploited again, which some people do.
The idea for any ghost that you're dealing with a traumatized author is exploited again is what we all would like to avoid. And I think that, you know, it's part of our job actually to try and negotiate between the publisher and the author. But like you say, sometimes there is this lack of communication and we have to be very careful with this. So from your experience, where do the publishers find these stories? I mean, is it something that, for example, that's appeared in a newspaper and they think actually this could be expanded into a book?
There's been all sorts of paths to publication, I think. And on occasion, an editor has come to me and said, we have this person, we approach them, we think they've got a terrific story, we would like to do their story. In one case, this happened. So I was put together with a author who had the most horrendous trauma, almost too shocking to be believed, but it was true. And it was actually had been reported in a court case. But several months down the line, after we'd done all the work, after we'd relived that trauma in order to get it down onto the page, and she was very grateful, she was very happy, like you, or you spend a lot of time sort of talking the process through with the author. At the end of all that, they then approached the lawyer who looked it over and said, no, you have to anonymize all of this. She can't say any of this. And so she had exposed herself and given all that information only to be told she couldn't say it from her point of view. And in fact, the reason she wanted to do it was because she wanted to launch a new career as a speaker, to speak out against domestic abuse and other forms of abuse, maybe go into schools and use that as her calling card. Now she couldn't, because she couldn't actually be associated with the book at all. That was one route. In other cases, people have approached me directly. I've had books published actually after somebody has read one of my books and decided they wanted to talk to me directly about their own story. I have an agent. Occasionally somebody will go to my agent with a story, and then he will put it to me and say, do you think this person might be worth having a conversation with? And we go that way. So there's all sorts of different directions, and there's no one route, I don't think, to publication.
And just so listeners understand some of the things we can and cannot say in books, I think there's quite a bit of confusion about it, isn't there? Because the libel laws in this country are pretty strict. When it comes to a court case, a conviction is necessary before that person can start saying, so-and-so did this to me, or I experienced this. So you need a criminal conviction if you're going to name the perpetrator. But there are cases where if the perpetrator has died, for example, you could pretty much say what you like. And there's also cases where if a story is anonymized, I mean, what's your experience of publishers and anonymous stories? Do they mind them as much as we think they do? In my experience, a lot of commissioning editors don't like them because they just want an author to be able to market the book.
I mean, strangely enough, a great deal of my stories have turned out to be anonymous for one reason or another. Yes, it's preferable to be named for purposes of publicity. As you know, they want them to sell the book at the end of the process by going on TV or doing interviews on the radio or in press or in other media. But in some cases, for example, I did The Secret Midwife. That was no impediment to publication and no impediment to sales. In fact, it worked quite well. The secret nature of her identity became something to celebrate. Because she was secret, she could give us the inside scoop. So very much in the same way, the secret barrister was somebody who was on the inside. That then can become something that you make something of. And if she did lots and lots of interviews, so it didn't stop her doing interviews. She was just not named or pictured. The funny thing about our laws is that actually there's quite a lot of ability to negotiate within them. And there's not one rule that will knock everything out. And in fact, not all lawyers are the same either. I've dealt with lawyers in some publishers who are much stricter than others. And things that I would have expected to get thrown out don't get thrown out. There's also a discrepancy sometimes with, okay, different courts will allow you to report in a different way. So for example, you can't report verbatim from a family court. You can't actually state what was said, but you can sort of report the themes and the direction of how things went. Whereas in a normal court, once it's said, you can report word for word. So it's quite complex. But what I tend to say to my authors is, here's a red flag. I'm going to put this up now and let you know this might be an area we might have to change because of the law. But I will put it in and let the lawyer throw it out. So my attitude is, I would like to get as much of this story in as authentically as possible. And it's not going to be my call if it gets thrown out or changed. And sometimes you can change things in a way, again, small changes, just a tweak that will make a big difference and make the lawyer happy, but allow the person to tell their story. But it can be a very sensitive process. I think, again, just telling people this process is going to come is important. Telling the authors the schedule. I don't think I've ever had an experience where an editor has sat down with an author and said, this happens then, this happens then, this comes next. Never. And yet it would seem to me so obvious to say, this is going to take a year from this point onwards, in order to manage expectations and to keep the author as comfortable in the process as possible, making it as transparent as possible. If you just tell them there's a legal read coming and this is what's going to happen. And after that, there's going to be a copy edit. And after that, there's going to be, you know, just so they have a clear idea of the direction of travel and expectations.
And do you think those within the publishers and the editors within the industry, they leave it to the ghostwriter because we have the most personal relationship with that person? Or do you think that actually, I mean, I know at the moment there's a lot of news about publishing industry people feeling very burnt out and short staff. There's a lot of movement within the industry, people coming and going, and they're just overworked. There's just too many projects. Do you think that that might be one of the reasons why the communication isn't as good as it could and should be?
I am in no doubt that the editors have too much on their plates. People's jobs have grown, perhaps, and expanded. And they do, if they know they're dealing with an experienced ghost, they will leave the managing of expectations in their hands. But I do think that the author needs to have a personal relationship with their publisher and to feel they're being looked after. And I don't think it takes that much to do, because they are, after all, the people who are in charge of all the decision making. It's not up to you and it's not up to me to make these decisions. Yes, we can help to smooth the way. Yes, we can help to negotiate the back and forths of the editorial process. But I think in the end, a little bit of attention goes a long way.
No, I completely agree. And as a ghost who obviously gets very close to these people and has to speak to very traumatized people and process that information and relive it on the page, how do you protect yourself?
That's been a question that's come up so many times, and I'm sure it has for you as well, Shannon. I always want to do a good job. So to me, of course, it's not a pleasant thing if you are getting some really highly traumatic things down on the page, but you know when you've done it authentically and accurately and to the satisfaction of the author, and there is an enormous amount of reward I feel when I have given that person their voice in that moment, and perhaps in that moment they have been silenced or they have been made to feel completely powerless. Giving them back that moment, giving them that voice, gives them back a little bit of power. So I actually find it very rewarding in that sense.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
When it comes to these stories, I think some of them are so extraordinary and extraordinarily troubling or outrageous that people sometimes struggle to believe they're true. But in my experience, and I'm sure yours as well, we're actually incredibly, strict is probably the wrong word, but we're incredibly challenged and careful to make sure that we do really get to the truth of the matter. And I always think that real life is always more strange than fiction, as they say.
Absolutely, 100%. There's nowhere to hide when you're having a very intimate conversation with somebody about those sort of moments. You can't really get away from how painful and raw it often is. And though everybody has different recollections, of course, there's a your truth and a my truth, etc., etc., that is undoubtedly their truth at that moment. You can't really get away from that. Yes, I think we do try and filter what we write through the prism of reality. And perhaps that's where a ghostwriter is very good and comes in very handy, because, of course, we can take a step back from what's happening and say, well, where was this person? Where was that person? And what time was this? And what was happening outside? And so we can actually frame the reality of the situation a little better. And if you do start digging and find that things fall apart, they don't often. They would very rarely do that in my experience. You can always leave it out. I've always found when I've dug down into the specifics of a situation, people have extraordinary memories. because it's a traumatic moment, because it's actually seared on their memory, they will be able to recall the most minute details.
Yes. Just going back to the honesty in the business, why do you think there is so little honesty about the money and the business side of the business? It's very much something that you just don't read about. It just seems this everlasting secret of how the industry works. You know, how do people get book deals? How much do they get? Yes. What is a decent advance? And we've talked through some of these issues during the podcast. What's your experience of that? And why do you think that does happen?
Yes, I agree. There is this enduring mystery about writing a book and enduring optimism about what it'll mean. You know, a bestseller means that you're going to make millions, but it's not true. And you can have a bestseller these days, as you know, on Amazon in a very specific category and sell literally five copies. You can be a bestseller of the charts that week and sell a few thousand copies, but it still doesn't translate as an awful lot of money, particularly because the royalties and the denominations break down in such a small way these days, especially these days with Amazon that discounts. And once they start discounting up to a certain percentage, your percentage of royalties gets even smaller. I think that there is something rather romantic about writing a book. I do think the publishing world likes to wrap itself in that romance still, perhaps considers itself a little bit above the rest of our cultural life in terms of the way we consume media. Books are so worthy and you have to be very intelligent to write or read or even whatever a book, that perhaps they do enjoy that mystique. But the truth of the matter is, if you are writing a book these days, you won't get a huge amount of money. A few thousand pounds maybe is about average.
One of your books became a number one bestseller, didn't it? Is it The Sins of the Mother?
Sins of the Mother, yes.
Can you tell us any more about, I know that there was talk of a couple of your books being made into films and things. I mean, again, there's a lot of mystery around that. I quite often get contacted by people who say my story, I've been told by so many people my story could be a film. And to be honest with you, that normally creates a few alarm bells, because I've sort of got the idea that, you know, anyone who tells me they've got a bestseller often hasn't. And it's the people who say, oh, do you really want to hear my story, that they're the ones with the best stories.
100%. That's usually a red flag for me, is when somebody tells me, oh, and you know, you can have a part of this incredible journey if you just write my book for free.
And it's bingo, isn't it? You just get one of those a week kind of thing. But in terms of your experience of it actually happening, I mean, can you talk us through, can you tell us anything about the possible potential film rights and things that were in the ether?
Again, it sounds wonderful, and I haven't had a book that's got to the point of development even for a pilot. So all I've got so far is a book that's been optioned for development. I don't think we even saw a script, but these things just sort of happen somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And as far as anything coming back, I haven't had anything further from that one. We had a bestseller with Sins of the Mother. That was very exciting. But again, in reality, it doesn't mean a huge amount. There's a time lag between the books you sell and the amount that you get paid. So royalties with most publishing companies are paid out twice a year for the 6 months previous to the one you've just experienced. So you might sell a lot of copies, but you're not going to see that money translated for at least usually about 12 months. And even then, there is a bit of a shock when you get your royalty checks and you realize that 7.5% of the units that you're selling doesn't add up to a huge amount, especially if they're being sold at a discount. It's rather nice. It's great for the ego. It's tremendously exciting when it happens. But as far as having bestseller, I don't think I can say there's a huge amount to it. I think for me, the most exciting moment usually is the point at which the book is published. And it's out there, and it is no longer the thing that you've been working on quietly with another person for a year and nobody else knows about or can read about. Now it has been delivered to the world. And it's kind of, for me, that feels like we've done it. Yes. We have achieved. And because it is a long process, and some say it's a bit of a feat of endurance. Yes, there's a lot of stages to get through, a lot of hurdles to get over. And sometimes it is a little bit painful because you have to go back and you have to change things you don't want to change. You're often asked to rewrite things or edit things or take things out in the process. And again, that I think should be shared with an author before they start so that they know to expect that coming down the line. So to get to the end point where you have a finished book and you can hold it up and say, here it is, here it is, the world can now read it. I think that's really exciting.
No, absolutely. I agree. In my experience, we've talked a bit about this, but the duty of care is often left to the ghostwriter as well in terms of dealing with the emotional impact, not just through the process, but afterwards as well. What boundaries, if any, do you put in place? Because, I mean, just from a personal experience, I've found it very hard to do that, particularly when I've become quite close to somebody. I do want to see that they're happy, and if they are ringing me late on a Sunday evening to talk through some issue, maybe they're having second thoughts about something, or they're worried about not being anonymous and they want to be anonymous after all, and that sort of thing. I mean, I think it's important to give that. I mean, we're dealing with people who are quite vulnerable sometimes, but also we're all human beings and we have developed a bond.
And there's considerations in place for somebody who is writing their story, no matter what that story is. We're ghost writers of people's real life stories. There are real life people out there this is going to affect. So even if it's quite an uncontroversial book about their job or something they've done that isn't particularly traumatic, it can still have knock-on effects. And seeing it written down for the first time, rather than just in the head, rather than just saying in a conversation, can be quite a sobering experience for a person. And they can suddenly think, or suddenly come up against this reality, which is everybody's going to see it and everybody's going to know this thing. And it could hurt some people. It could cause them problems within their family, friendships, or at work. There are lots of different considerations you don't even know, they don't even know, until you start off down this road. What I think is that the process has a natural curve to it. And you do start off sort of as strangers. And then you become like almost like the closest person you can imagine to this person. You're hearing things and they're telling you things they haven't shared with another living soul. You are their confidant, they're intimate, and in a way, I don't have any sort of rules. You know, if that's the moment where I need to be there for them at 4 in the morning, fine, I will, because I know that we're going through something together. But as the book becomes a little bit less about you and them and a little bit more about the publishing, other people involved, then you all take a step back, I think, naturally. And they recognize as well that there are natural boundaries in place about what they can say and the extent to which you can then make a decision, because somebody else might be making that decision for them. Yes, we are there to absolutely guide them, hold their hand. I haven't put in place any sort of boundaries whatsoever, because it's a remarkable process, and I think it's an absolute honour. And every single book that I have done has left its mark on me as a person. And changed me and given me things. I see it as this is part of the journey. I feel very privileged.
And I don't think there's any other way of doing it either. This isn't something you can do sort of half in, half out, or kind of, you know, sort of part time. You really have to try and live that person's life, allow them in to your life. We've got three more questions, Katie, that we ask everybody at the end. On your fantasy bookshelf, which books have you ghosted?
I'm always fascinated by real life, and I always want to have the inside scoop on what are the big stories of our time. So I was really taken up with that Alex Murdoch story, the lawyer father who murdered his own wife and son. And I really would like to get in on that story and see what the truth is of the matter there. I'd like to interview him, have him be honest about what happened. And I think that would be fascinating, because it was so shocking. which is unusual for me because I normally would be interested in hearing the victim's story. But in this case, I'm really interested in hearing the perpetrator's story.
Question number two, what's the biggest secret that you can tell us? It could be anything.
It's our job to keep the secrets. I don't think writing is all that difficult. I think writing, everybody can do it. Sometimes it's just a question of knowing the structure or having an instinct for putting down on the page the things that are going through your head. Mm. And it's just a question of accessing those thoughts. I think everybody can write. And I have been very inspired by a lot of my authors, by the things they've written. So sometimes I've taken on a job because somebody has written a little thing about their story. And I thought, that's brilliant. I love the way they've expressed it. People are innately communicative. Mm. People have that within them. And sometimes what they're saying is just, it just writes itself. That's perfect. What you've said there is perfect for the page. All they've needed is another person to communicate it to. Some people find getting that down on the page and communicating with the page easy, and other people find it easier to talk it through. But in the end, they're still writers. They're just writing vocally.
Great answer. Final question. What's the title for the book about your life?
Katie White's the legend.
I love it.
It's not a whitewash. I don't know.
We'd have your face on the cover, Katie, just like Prince Harry's, just a nice, lovely big black and white.
It's not black and whites. I don't know. Some stupid pun on my name, probably.
Oh, brilliant. I love that too. Oh, well, thank you ever so much, Katie. It's been absolutely fascinating chat, and it's absolutely brilliant to have you on. I could talk all day, but thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, I could too. It's really nice. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate it. It's been lovely talking to another ghost.
That was fascinating. It was really interesting to hear somebody talk in such detail about libel laws and what to expect when you tell your story. A lot of people come to ghosts and have great ideas what they want to say, but they don't realise what you can and can't say, what we're able to say. We're always very cautious and say, has it been through a court of law? And just to actually spell out exactly what those criteria are is really helpful.
Yes, as Katie said, you know, there's so much secrecy surrounding this, and none of us can really kind of work out why, because it's not in anyone's best interest that we don't really know how it works. I mean, obviously, it's only when you actually come to write a book that you start to realise, well, I can say this and I can't say that. But like we said, it's kind of down to the ghost to explain that a lot of the time.
But it can be a bit of a minefield as well. I mean, as Katie was saying, and as we probably both found too, one tendency is to like push things as far as you can possibly go. You kind of know what you can get into a book and what you can't. And then a lawyer will come along and go, well, absolutely not. Or, oh yeah, that's fine. Yeah. It's always a bit like, oh, I was convinced. So you're never quite sure. But if you know some of the rules, then you can break them or push it as far as you can to get a good book.
Exactly. Publishers always want you to push it as far as you can. That's what they say. It's always the thing that you kind of not sure whether you can or can't say that's usually the most interesting thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now it's time for our regular segment, Digging Up the Ghost Past, when we look at a ghost written book from times gone by. What have you got for me this week, Shannon?
Well, we've got For a Promised Land by Barack Obama, which I'm sure pretty much everybody on this planet has heard of. What was intriguing is the fact that we're just looking into it, and Obama's description of his working process. He talks about working primarily between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., starting out by writing the first drafts longhand on yellow legal pads, always using a black Uniball Vision Elite roller pen. I mean, that's kind of a bit too much detail in my book.
What I'd like to add to that, because he passionately says he doesn't work with ghostwriters. And in fact, his party piece is apparently outing Michelle, his wife, for the fact that she's had a ghostwriter for her book Becoming. And the only thing I would add to this, because obviously I have huge respect for Obama, and I know he's incredibly eloquent having heard him speak, but there are times that I have heard authors that I've worked with appear on on radio and TV, explaining in great detail their writing process, how they come downstairs and they have a coffee and they sit in their favourite chair and they think about it. And I tend to feel the more detail that they describe in this writing process, the more that perhaps they might be hiding something. But this may be unfair. This may be unfair.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that we don't sort of waft around lighting candles and kind of, you know, bringing down the muse and having like certain pens to write with. Yeah, we just kind of sit down and get on with it, really, don't we? And I think if the author says that, you're just kind of like, okay.
I wish I could waft around with my candles and waiting for my muse. It sounds wonderful, right?
Well, I've got to say, A Promised Land is a brilliant book. So if anyone hasn't read it, which I'm sure pretty much nobody, like, please do.
And kudos to Obama, who
Yes, we love him. That's all for today. Thanks so much for joining us. And of course, huge thanks to Katie Whites for coming on the show. See you next time when we'll be joined by another fantastic guest. But goodbye for now.
Bye. Giving Up the Ghost Cast is produced by Amanda Redman and brought to you by the Ghostwriters Agency.
Thanks so much for joining us. Please remember to rate and review us on your listening app. It helps us to get noticed in the noisy world of podcasts.
Yes, it does. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so by going to theghostwritersagency.com
or following us on Twitter at GW Agency Ghosts.
See you next time. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.